Too many people in America fear their government, and the government is being run by too many powerful agencies like the IRS and others. I think it's time the people take the country back through their representative government.
You are listening to an American Free Press podcast. The complete reading of American Free Press weekly newspaper, number 7, February 14, 2011. Shanghai, USA, by Mark Anderson. Because today's planetary plutocrats seek a borderless globe, we have endured the agony of free trade. Thus, we export manufacturing jobs and import things we can make ourselves from slave factories overseas. This spurs the infamous race to the bottom, as wages plummet and the remaining jobs huddle at the fragile retail level to sell the imports. But imagine a program that solicits alien investors to create or salvage business developments in America, but does not require them to hire Americans. In other words, foreign companies could buy up key parts of the country and then populate them with their own people, and there would be nothing local residents could do about the situation. Welcome to what are broadly known as foreign trade zones, or FTZs, about which many details are just becoming clear. Idaho Eagle Forum President Jane Lesko has been leading the charge against them. These zones feature industrial and warehouse districts and many other developments and projects in high unemployment areas across America. Designated and administered by federal agencies, FTZs represent what Lesko calls economic colonization. And since Red China is a major player in this scheme, Chinese companies and investors are coming to America, as Lesko told AFP. Lower-paid Indian and Asian computer technicians utilizing employment visas already have replaced countless American technicians, some of whom were forced to train their own replacements before being pink-slipped. As for FTZs, consider the following. The new jobs associated with them need not be numerous and do not have to go to Americans, Lesko stressed, adding, the investors use EB-5 foreign investor visas. They can make $1 million investments to start a new business and create 10 jobs. Or with $500,000, they could buy a distressed business and create 10 jobs. Or invest $500,000 into an EB-5 regional center made up of private businesses. The investor is given a green card and in 5 years can get U.S. citizenship, if desired. A Chinese entity, Sinomach, plans to build a technology zone of up to 30,000 acres south of the Boise, Idaho airport for homes, retail centers, and other Chinese businesses. In June 2010, Idaho Governor Butch Otter and a delegation, including business people, went on a Chinese trade mission. Governor Otter invited the communist Chinese to bring their money and move to Idaho to invest in our economy through the EB-5 visas, Lesko noted. In this brave new world of green cards for aliens, pink slips for Americans, several other state delegations have taken similar actions, soliciting the communist Chinese to buy American citizenship via the EB-5 visas. This issue joins the ranks of the massive Trans-Texas Corridor, the sale of U.S. toll roads to foreign investors, and other major public-private partnerships that exploit the many for the illicit gain of the few. Stay tuned. Page 2, personal from the editor. Economic vampires. Usury, the eternal scourge of mankind, drains society of its lifeblood by requiring mushrooming interest on all the credit and money lent into circulation by those who are really in the driver's seat, the bankers. They run the governments that rule us. Morality is not relevant to them. As AFP has reported, the recent popular uprisings against austerity measures leveled at the people of several European nations are part of the resistance. The other part is not as noisy, but they have the goods and the bankers and are willing to press for badly needed changes to return financial sovereignty to the people and what should be their nations. Until that restoration is done, the rulers of nations will behave like they do now, like they're serving someone else. A good dose of the solution for this grand dilemma can be found in an upcoming symposium called Economics as if God Matters. I have been invited to speak and look forward to sharing some thoughts while talking about AFP and what it has been doing on the monetary issue, always a hot topic in these troubled times. One of the top academics of our day, Dr. E. Michael Jones, publisher of Culture Wars magazine, is putting on this event March 19th in Indiana near Notre Dame University. Jones notes, correctly I believe, that the type of capitalism we now have is state-sponsored usury. As we go to press, AFP's Victor Thorne is soon to be speaking at Freedom Law School's annual conference in California. Organizer Peyman Motadeh promises a roster of many other notable speakers as well. Also, Victor's last book in his trilogy on the origins and major players in the New World Order, entitled New World Order Assassins, is featured in the wraparound for this issue. Learn about those who commit terrible crimes on behalf of a hidden agenda, which, due to work such as this and other books AFP promotes, are not as hidden as they once were. Also, take note that, as reported in our weekly Spotlight on Congress Inside, Senator Rand Paul is calling for ending foreign aid to the bellicose state of Israel. Concerned citizens need to carefully watch this matter and make sure this important goal is not pursued deceptively. Still, as a fiscal matter, foreign aid itself to any nation is unconstitutional and counterproductive. Let Senator Paul know how you feel. Call his office at 202-224-4343. Mark Anderson. Son of famed pilot, a believer in liberty. The Cold War Museum in Vint Hill, Virginia, just so happens to include an exhibit on the USS Liberty, the American military vessel blindsided by an unprovoked attack by Israeli forces in June of 1967. An interesting inclusion at an institution about the Cold War. As if that is not enough, Francis Gary Powers Jr., the museum's founder, is the son of Francis Gary Powers, the American intelligence pilot who was shot down in a U-2 spy plane while flying over the USSR in 1960. So, his father's exploits are enshrined in history. Last year, notably, the younger Powers visited Russia on the 50th anniversary of his dad's ordeal. Who owns the U.S. now? In early February, the Federal Reserve surpassed China for the first time ever as the largest holder of U.S. Treasury securities. The Financial Times reports that the New York Fed is now sitting on $1.1 trillion worth of bonds, notes, and other securities. China has been scaling back its holdings and now has $896 billion. Japan is third in line with $877 billion. Boomtown, New York. While the rest of the country continues to suffer record-high unemployment and home foreclosures, pay on Wall Street has never been better. According to the Wall Street Journal, salaries and benefits at the top 25 investment banking firms totaled $135 billion in 2010, up nearly 6% from 2009's $128 billion. Human guinea pigs. Vanity Fair recently revealed a shocking new insight into the way drugs are being tested on people before they are released on the market for the public. Prescription drugs kill some 200,000 Americans every year, reported Vanity Fair in its January 1st issue. Will that number go up now that most clinical trials are conducted overseas? On sick Russians, homeless Poles, and slum-dwelling Chinese. In places where regulation is virtually non-existent, the FDA doesn't reach, and mistakes can end up in paupers' graves. South Dakota could make gun ownership mandatory. Legislation introduced into South Dakota's state legislature would require any adult over the age of 21 to purchase a firearm sufficient to provide for their self-defense. Do I or the other co-sponsors believe that the state of South Dakota can require citizens to buy firearms? State Representative Hal Wick, Republican Sioux Falls, asked a local newspaper. Of course not, but at the same time, we do not believe the federal government can order every citizen to buy health insurance. You can run. Foreign press sources note that families who are uncertain about the paternity of their children can now get a DIY test over the counter at one of the UK's leading high street pharmacies. This is the UK's first ever approved and regulated DNA paternity testing kit. It provides results within 5 days. Cotton swabs are used to take samples from inside the mouths of the parents and the child. Sealed samples are then sent in for analysis. News you may have missed. Can't force it. Citing hypocrisy on the part of President Obama, federal judge in Florida put another nail into Obamacare, the president's national health plan. On February 1st, U.S. District Judge Roger Vinson ruled that the federal government cannot force Americans to purchase a product from a private company. While campaigning for the White House in 2008, Obama said, "If mandating health care was the solution, we can try that to solve homelessness by mandating everybody to buy a house." The burbs in reverse. Suburban America is losing its white population as young white Americans move into the cities in search of fleeting jobs and leave behind a disproportionate number of the elderly and minorities. As a result, says Associated Press, suburbs now have the largest number of poor people in the country. Once upon a time, many upwardly mobile people fled the cities for the good life in suburbia. All that glitters. Eric Sprott, the CEO of a well-known Toronto-based asset management firm, told silverminers.com that he envisions an ounce of gold going for $2,155 and silver valued at $64 an ounce by this spring. With oil topping $100 a barrel, his prediction may not be that far off. Too many vacancies. The Census Bureau's latest quarterly homeowner vacancy and homeownership report shows that, for the fourth quarter in 2010, approximately 11% of all homes in the United States were vacant. That amounts to 18.4 million houses across the United States. Page 4. Conspiracy Fact. Details of Capitol Hill staffer's death don't add up. By Victor Thorne. On January 10th, former Capitol Hill staffer Ashley Turton was found in the early morning hours, burned and dead inside her 2008 BMW X5. According to the official account, at 4:50 a.m., as Mrs. Turton began backing her German-made SUV out of the family garage, she ran into something. Inexplicably, her trunk then exploded into flames, engulfing the vehicle. The low-impact crash occurred at such a low speed that Mrs. Turton's airbag never deployed. With over 1 million BMW X5s on the road, there have been only a couple reports of X5s catching fire, and usually those involve neglect or other clear maintenance problems. This incident would be strange enough if that were the end of the story, but there appears to be much more going on here. This writer interviewed a D.C. private investigator who said, "The victim didn't even make an attempt to exit her vehicle. Why didn't she try to escape?" His question is valid, especially in light of statements from Pete Pieringer, spokesman for the District of Columbia's Fire Department. According to his leading theory, Mrs. Turton's SUV impacted some unknown, extremely flammable material, which caused the fire. But if that is true, and considering that she wasn't obstructed by an airbag, why didn't Mrs. Turton simply step out of her car and leave the garage? Is it conceivable that Mrs. Turton was murdered and then placed inside the BMW, which was then set ablaze to make it appear as a freak accident, destroying crucial evidence at the same time? Before ruling out this possibility, consider that Mrs. Turton was half of a D.C. power couple that knew deep insider secrets. Mrs. Turton's husband, Dan, served as President Barack Obama's Deputy Director of Legislative Affairs for the House of Representatives. In this capacity, he acted as a White House liaison, working closely with the former House Speaker, Representative Nancy Pelosi, Democrat, California, to push Obama's $800 billion stimulus package and Wall Street bailout legislation through the House. Mr. Turton's relationship with Pelosi turned sour after White House spokesman Robert Gibbs predicted Democrats would suffer losses in last year's midterms. According to Stephanie Condon in a July 14, 2010 article for CBS News, Pelosi reportedly grilled White House staffer Dan Turton, the top aide at the meeting. Mrs. Turton also had a connection to the former speaker. Siobhan Hughes of Dow Jones News reported that Mrs. Turton had worked as a special assistant in the office of House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. More importantly, Mrs. Turton acted as press secretary and then chief of staff for Representative Rosa DeLauro, Democrat, Connecticut, from 2000 to 2007. What makes this significant is that Obama's handler, dual Israeli citizen Rahm Emanuel, lived rent-free in DeLauro's home for 5 years. To make matters even more interesting, Owen Thomas of the online news site Gawker revealed in a February 2009 article that Emanuel's residence was wired for audio and video. Mrs. DeLauro is married to Democratic pollster Stanley Greenberg, whose firm made substantial efforts to soft soap British Petroleum both before and during the 2010 Gulf oil spill. Former Bill Clinton strategist Dick Morris wrote in the New York Post on February 17, 2009, that Emanuel, while chairman of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, paid Greenberg's firm $239,996 in 2006 and $317,775 in 2008 for consulting work.
journalist Matt Gaetz adds another piece to their incestuous relationship in a June 8, 2010 article. "It was Greenberg who brought Emanuel into Clinton's 1992 campaign," wrote Gaetz. "When Greenberg's daughter got married, Emanuel performed the ceremony. Greenberg's wife, Mrs. DeLauro, played her part by co-sponsoring the widely criticized Food Safety Modernization Act, H.R. 875, in 2009. On April 20, 2009, Brian Doherty described this bill, which greatly benefits corporate farmers, as effectively criminalizing organic gardening and outlawing seed banking. The Obama administration pushed this legislation, creating a conflict of interest because Greenberg had Monsanto as one of his major clients. Considering Emanuel's deep contacts within BP, one final element to this equation must be introduced. After leaving the employ of Mrs. DeLauro, Mrs. Turton became Director of Congressional Affairs for Progress Energy. In this position, Turton was responsible for easing business deals through governmental agencies. On the morning of her death, Mrs. Turton's Progress Energy announced it intended to merge with Duke Energy, creating America's largest utility company. Mrs. Turton undoubtedly would have played a pivotal role in getting this multi-billion dollar deal approved on Capitol Hill. Mrs. Turton was on her way to the airport to attend this merger meeting the morning her BMW mysteriously caught fire and burned her body. List of Project Censored stories mirrors AFP reporting by Dave Gahary. If you've ever wanted proof that big media is not giving you all the news that's fit to print, you don't have to look too far. Project Censored has compiled the top 25 censored stories of 2009-2010 in their latest book, Censored 2011. The missing stories run the gamut of what your average American might want to know if given the opportunity from the corporate media. A sampling of the censored stories includes global plans to replace the dollar, ICE operates secret detention courts, U.S. funds and supports the Taliban, the H1N1 swine flu pandemic, manipulating data to enrich drug companies, increased tensions with unresolved 9/11 issues, and 1.2 billion people in India to be given biometric ID cards. If it sounds as if Project Censored is towing the line of American Free Press, they are. The Media Project has featured stories from AFP's precursor, The Spotlight. Founded in 1976 by journalism professor Carl Jensen, Project Censored has published a review of the top 25 censored stories of the year since 1993 and has as its main goal the advocacy and protection of First Amendment rights and freedom of information in the United States. As would be expected, the Media Project has been attacked by the usual suspects and has even experienced a fissure in its ranks, similar to what happened to the 9/11 Truth Movement and its failure to consider Israel's apparent involvement in the false flag attacks. It seems even the alternative progressive press wants no further serious examination of the events leading up to and including the attacks of September 11, 2001, the 10th anniversary of which is this year. Or as the book's introduction states, there has been a complete mainstream press omerta conspiracy of silence on the discrepancies in the official story. Mickey S. Huff, an associate professor of history at Diablo Valley College and the current director of Project Censored, sat down with American Free Press to discuss the project. AFP asked Huff why, in his opinion, there is censorship in the first place. Why not just present true stories to the public? Huff's answer was a strictly economic one, comparing the corporate media to any other for-profit business. Reporting the truth is not the corporate media's prime concern. Rather, selling eyeballs to advertisers is, explained Huff. He used a quote from American journalist A.J. Liebling to illustrate the dilemma. Freedom of the press is guaranteed only to those who own one. Although Huff doesn't believe the media is run by a Jewish conspiracy, he believes there is ongoing bias in the U.S. corporate press that minimizes criticizing Israeli policy in the Mideast. The sorry state of affairs of today's American news consumer was also brought up to Huff. Isn't the steady diet of junk food news and infotainment simply giving the people what they want? Why do many seem more interested in the latest celebrities' antics instead of how three steel-framed buildings in the same complex could completely collapse from fire on the same day, although there has never been one recorded example, before or since, of that type of building being demolished by fire? Holding out hope for the public, Huff countered that polls suggest otherwise, indicating he believes Americans are genuinely interested in real news, not the pabulum that is fed to them by the mainstream media. Page 6, AFP on terrorism. Tape of firefighters inside WTC-2 reveals no towering inferno, by Victor Thorne. According to the feds, we are supposed to believe that a raging inferno blazed with such intensity that it caused the steel girders of the 110-story World Trade Center Twin Towers to melt and ultimately collapse. This part of the official government 9/11 story regarding the events in New York City, despite tremendous amounts of propaganda, hasn't withstood scientific scrutiny, nor does video evidence support such a ridiculous thesis. Now, Major Reginald Shin and his son Richard have released a short documentary entitled Let Me Know When You See Fire that examines the final 10 minutes of radio dispatches by firemen on the morning of September 11, 2001. During a January 27th interview, Shin told this writer, "We know from hearing these tapes that the firemen had reached the 79th floor. There was nothing hysterical in their voices as the firemen talked back and forth among each other. Again, the public has been led to believe that WTC-2, the South Tower, was engulfed in flames that reached thousands of degrees within the minutes prior to its collapse. But at one point, Joseph Levy of NYFD Battalion 15 is heard on the audio tape saying, 'Let me know when you see fire.' On another transmission, only 7 minutes before the South Tower fell, Deputy Chief Oreo Palmer is heard telling his colleagues that he had just reached the 78th floor. He then states, 'We've got two isolated pockets of fire. We should be able to knock it down with two lines.' Palmer was directly on the scene, and he spoke these words matter-of-factly, without any impending sense that catastrophe was only moments away." Richard Shin, the producer of this film, commented to AFP, "After hearing these tapes, it's clear that conditions inside the South Tower were relatively normal. They were routinely doing what they were supposed to do." To augment this sentiment, Shin asked, "These firemen were professionals. Many had been in emergency situations for most of their lives. So, why would they set up command posts in the lobbies of WTC 1 and 2 if they thought there was any possibility of danger, or that the towers would come crashing down?" Undoubtedly, the most startling aspect of this film involves the audio tape's abrupt ending just 2 minutes prior to the collapse of WTC 2. Richard Shin described how local Port Authority officials redacted the final 2 minutes and wouldn't release its contents even when faced with a Freedom of Information Act ruling. An obvious question is, what is in these final seconds of audio tape that the public isn't allowed to hear? On one hand, this decision may have been made on humane grounds to prevent any further morbidity from tainting an already horrifying situation. Or did the firemen react to massive internal explosions that ultimately felled the towers? Obviously, these rescue workers, calm and businesslike up until that point, would have voiced their terror and alarm as the tremendous amount of energy required to topple these massive structures exploded and echoed around them. If the public ever heard their frantic words or descriptions, the government's cover story of office fires melting tons upon tons of internal steel columns would immediately melt away. Survivors say underwear bomber was set up by feds, by Pat Shannon. The infamous underwear bomber, Umar Farouk Abdul Muttalab, appeared in federal court in Detroit in late January and finally had a trial date set for October 4th. He has refused court-appointed counsel and intends to defend himself against the charge that he attempted to blow up Northwest Airlines Flight 253 from Amsterdam to Detroit on Christmas Day 2009. But the bigger part of the story is being suppressed by the mainstream press. And even local Detroit WJBK TV reporter Amy Lang noticed as much, telling her evening news audience, "It was actually more interesting to hear from a couple of the passengers that showed up at court. Kurt and Lori Haskell think the U.S. government was behind the whole thing." Not only are this husband and wife attorney team of nearby Taylor, Michigan, some of the most unlikely witnesses, but the circumstantial evidence surrounding their testimony may be strong enough to torpedo what they consider to be a bogus prosecution. However, they have not yet been called as defense witnesses. The Haskells had been vacationing in Europe and were in line at the boarding gate when they saw Abdul Muttalab attempting to board the flight without a passport. When the ticket agent objected and halted Abdul Muttalab, a man in a tan suit and speaking with an American accent intervened, saying something along the lines of, "He's okay, we do this all the time." The agent then passed the two of them on to a supervisor, and a few minutes later, the Haskells witnessed Abdul Muttalab being taken on board to his seat. The bomb ignited, as opposed to exploded, shortly after takeoff, causing a small fire, a temporary panic on board, and an emergency turnaround and landing. There was no serious damage to the plane or to Abdul Muttalab, which certainly prompted the witness's next statement. The U.S. government escorted him through security without a passport and, we believe, gave him an intentionally defective bomb. Haskell was quoted as saying from the courthouse steps by local media. It was intentional that it went this far, to further the war on terror, to get body scanners in the airports, to increase the TSA's budget, to renew the Patriot Act, and whatever other reasons you want to list. The Haskells routinely appear in the same courtroom as attorneys several times a month, but they sat in the gallery that day. On February 1st, Haskell told AFP, "I'm not backing down. They will have to kill me to shut me up." Page 8, AFP Spotlight on Congress. Rand Paul says over $500 billion can be hacked from the budget. Newly elected Senator Rand Paul, Republican, Kentucky, introduced on January 25th the Cut Federal Spending Act, which jettisons a whopping $500 billion out of the federal government's budget for fiscal year 2011. That amounts to an unprecedented 25% of Washington's total spending for the year. In the February 7th issue, AFP editors detailed a proposal by the Republican Study Committee, which proposed dumping some $100 billion from federal appropriations. AFP published the list of programs that the conservative caucus wanted to terminate, but even that proposal pales in comparison to Paul's landmark measure. In announcing his new bill, Paul said, "The solution to the government's fiscal crisis needs to begin by cutting spending at the heart of the problem, right here on Capitol Hill." In a nutshell, Paul plans on returning government spending to 2008 levels, cutting almost all federal programs down to the bone. He wants to completely defund the government printing office, which will save taxpayers billions. He is also looking to significantly cut the budgets of the federal judiciary, $2.4 billion, the Environmental Protection Agency, $3.2 billion, and departments such as Agriculture, $42 billion, Commerce, $5.3 billion, Energy, $27 billion, Education, $16 billion, Health and Human Services, $26.5 billion, Interior, $11 billion, Labor, $2.8 billion, State, $20 billion, Transportation, $43 billion, and Housing and Urban Development, among other things. Paul also wants to scale back U.S. war spending by $70 billion and cut Homeland Security by $25 billion. Finally, he calls for collecting unpaid taxes from federal employees, $3 billion, freezing federal workers' pay, $2 billion, selling off unused federal property, $19 billion, and repealing the banker bailout known as the Troubled Asset Relief Program, $4.5 billion. By removing programs that are beyond the constitutional role of the federal government, such as education and housing, we are cutting nearly 40% of our projected deficit and removing the big government bureaucrats who stand in the way of efficiency in our federal government, he said. Paul also said he wants to cut all foreign aid. CNN host and former AIPAC staffer Wolf Blitzer asked if that included Israel. Paul replied, "When you send foreign aid, you actually send quite a bit to Israel's enemies. Islamic nations around Israel get quite a bit of foreign aid too," said Paul. "I don't support funding both sides of the arms race, particularly when we have to borrow the money from China to send it to someone else. We just can't do it anymore." Tea Party is targeting big-name incumbents. The heads of some 70 populist grassroots Tea Party groups came together in late January to compile a list of Republican incumbents who they want voted out of office in the 2012 elections. According to a report in a New York Daily, some of the longest-serving Republicans are in the crosshairs of Tea Party organizations. They include Senators Richard Lugar, Indiana, Olympia Snow, Maine, and Orrin Hatch, Utah, among others. As far as Lugar is concerned, the leaders of the patriotic groups point to his support of liberal legislation, such as the DREAM Act, which would provide amnesty for millions of illegal aliens currently hiding out in the United States, as well as his backing for liberal high court picks Sonia Sotomayor and Elena Kagan. The senator would call it bipartisanship, but we think he's siding with the other side, Tea Party supporter Greg Fettig told the New York Times. The problem may come, though, when real grassroots Tea Party groups like the Tea Party Patriots come face-to-face with establishment-backed astroturf groups like Sal Russo's Tea Party Express. For example, the Tea Party Express has already said it will not oppose any top Republicans. In the coming year, truly conservative Americans may be able to separate the wheat from the chaff when it comes to Tea Party groups by observing which of the politicians they back. GOP shoots down public gun control hearings. There's an old joke about gun control that goes like this. A homeowner who had just shot an armed robber breaking into his house is asked by a local reporter for his feelings about gun control. Unshaken, the man quips, "The only gun control I care about is whether I can hit my target." In the wake of the shooting in Tucson of Representative Gabrielle Giffords, Democrat, Arizona, Democrats in the House are screaming for a public probe of gun control under the auspices of investigating the National Instant Criminal Background Check System, NICS, NICS, the law that requires a federally licensed gun dealer to do a cursory background check on any American interested in purchasing a firearm. Representative John Conyers, Democrat, Michigan, and 15 of his Democratic colleagues signed on to a public letter calling for hearings. So far, the head of the House Judiciary Committee has been able to deflect the calls from ranking committee members, but he may not be able to hold them back forever. House Judiciary Committee Chairman Lamar Smith, Republican, Texas, told the Capitol Hill Daily that he would support a study of laws that are intended to keep guns out of the hands of insane people, drug dealers, and other criminals, but he would not be party to a Democrat-initiated public relations stunt. He added that Congress should wait until the trial has ended for Jared Lohner, the lunatic who is being prosecuted for shooting Mrs. Giffords and at least 18 other people. The Judiciary Committee should, at the appropriate time, undertake a review of the NICS system as a part of our oversight of Justice Department programs, said Smith in response to the Democrats' letter. But to undertake such a review in the context of the tragic shooting in Arizona, as the minority suggests, could have the unintended effect of prejudicing the ongoing criminal proceedings against Lohner, in which his mental status is likely to be a key issue. Jared Lohner has not been found to be mentally ill. It is inappropriate for Congress to hold hearings on NICS that presume otherwise while Lohner is facing trial. The NICS system is intended to keep gun dealers from selling firearms to known criminals, ex-convicts, and crazy people. Barring lawbreakers is certainly easy enough. But how does one judge who is mentally unstable? Truly, by Washington's elitist standards, anyone who is openly opposed to foreign interventionism, big government, the income tax, and water fluoridation could be considered nuts. That's what makes calls for more gun control so dangerous to our rights, as some in Congress would love nothing more than to either totally ban gun ownership or make it so difficult that it becomes impossible for the average American to obtain a firearm. Page 9, AFP on illegal immigration. States rush to copy Arizona's tougher immigration law, by Ralph Forbes. Legislators in states across the country have introduced or are preparing bills similar to Arizona's SB 1070 to defend America's borders, since the federal government will not sufficiently do so. Bills in the past few weeks have been introduced or are in preparation in Oregon, Indiana, South Carolina, Mississippi, Colorado, Nebraska, Georgia, Florida, Rhode Island, Nevada, Oklahoma, some 20 states, although most are treading water to see how the Arizona case fares. A Mississippi bill was passed by the state Senate by a 35-15 vote on January 18th. It would allow state law enforcement officers to check the status of people they think might be in the U.S. illegally. It also makes it illegal for a person to knowingly conceal or harbor an illegal immigrant. It still needs to pass in the House. Republican Colorado Senator Kent Lambert has introduced SB 54, which would allow police to arrest any individual if there is probable cause to believe that he or she is in America illegally. In Nebraska, Republican State Senator Charlie Jansen introduced a bill that would require peace officers, when enforcing other laws, to question the immigration status of people they suspect of being in the U.S. illegally. It would also require non-U.S. citizens to carry documents showing legal status. Florida Representative William Snyder, also a Republican, has proposed a bill based on the Arizona law. In 2007, the Show Me State placed on the ballot a proposed constitutional amendment designating English as the official language of Missouri. In November of 2008, nearly 90% voted in favor of it. Thus, English became the official language for all state governmental activities in Missouri. No one has the right to demand government services in a language other than English. In 2008, a measure was passed that required law enforcement officials to verify the immigration status of any person arrested and inform federal authorities if the person is found to be in Missouri illegally. In 2009, a measure was passed that ensures Missouri's public institutions of higher education do not provide financial aid to individuals who are in the U.S. illegally. Page 10, AFP on the Mideast. Catastrophic Zionism, How Turmoil Benefits Israel, by Michael Collins Piper. If there is anything that can be said about the crisis in Egypt, which is reverberating throughout the Middle East, it is that it is ultimately open to multiple interpretations. Any expert who purports to give you the last word on the topic is deceiving you, and perhaps himself. Geopolitical strategists, armchair pundits, and conspiracy theory devotees are competing to tell the world what's really happening and why, but there is no single truth to the matter. First of all, consider the issue of popular unrest in Egypt. All serious evidence indicates Hosni Mubarak's regime has sustained itself through force and oppression and, not surprisingly, support from the Egyptian military. In addition, Mubarak has maintained a close relationship with the United States and thus with Israel, with which Egypt entered a controversial peace agreement in 1979 that remains in effect today. These factors have preserved Mubarak's rule, at least until now. However, within Egypt, there has long been widespread discontent among a variety of domestic sources, ranging from Islamic fundamentalists in the Muslim Brotherhood to more Western-oriented young people to working families struggling to pay food bills. So while there is breadth and apparent depth to the opposition, the critics of Mubarak are by no means united across a wide range of issues. However, the economic turmoil plaguing Egypt in recent months seems to have been a critical factor in helping spark the rebellion. In short, to suggest that the Egyptian rebellion was orchestrated solely by the United States and/or Israel would ignore genuine grassroots Egyptian concerns. Israel and the American supporters of Israel know that many Egyptians of all political stripes and religious persuasions have never been comfortable with the U.S.-Israeli-Egyptian relationship, and that an element of Egyptian opposition to the Mubarak regime has been its cozy concert with Israel. As a consequence of this, many pro-Israeli elements are taking a firm stand against democracy in Egypt, precisely because they fear a popularly elected regime replacing Mubarak could be hostile to Israel, no matter what the new regime's religious flavor, if any at all. Note, too, that one of the leading critics of the Mubarak regime is Nobel Prize-winning former International Atomic Energy Agency chief Mohammed El-Baradei. Supporters of Israel consider El-Baradei to be problematic because he was a critic of the Bush administration's campaign against Saddam Hussein of Iraq, raising questions about Bush claims that Saddam was engaged in building nuclear weapons. Likewise, El-Baradei has stood in the way of Israeli and American efforts to provoke a confrontation with Iran over its efforts to engage in nuclear development. However, there are more than a few observers who perceive El-Baradei as a ubiquitous double dealer whose agenda is uncertain. In the meantime, despite all of this, it is not a stretch of the imagination to believe that Israel could stand to benefit from turmoil in Egypt. The average observer might find this difficult to understand. While most rational people would assume that Israel would prefer to have neighboring states that are stable, successful participants in the region, this is not necessarily the case. In fact, a carefully crafted think piece entitled A Strategy for Israel in the 1980s, featured in the February 1982 edition of the World Zionist Organization's Jerusalem-based publication, Kivunim, a journal for Judaism and Zionism, candidly put forth an Israeli strategy to wreak havoc in the Arab world, dividing the Arab states from within. The author was Oded Yonon, an Israeli journalist with close ties to Israel's foreign ministry. The program, which amounted to balkanizing the various Arab republics, splitting them into religious enclaves in which, for example, Shiite Muslims or otherwise Sunni Muslims would predominate, was an agenda that Israeli dissident Israel Shahak said, quite simply, was designed to make an imperial Israel into a world power by disrupting the Arab states and thereby setting the stage for Israeli dominance in the Mideast. The formula was founded on the idea of creating chaos among Israel's Arab neighbors, hardly a policy any decent, well-meaning neighbor could be credited for fostering. In fact, the current-day political and religious divisions and devastation in Iraq the consequence of the American invasion of Iraq demanded by the pro-Israel lobby in Washington, mirrors precisely what the Zionist position paper laid forth as the ideal state of affairs for Iraq, from an Israeli point of view, that is. But where does Egypt fit into all of this? Reflecting on the Zionist strategy paper, Ralph Schoenman, an eminent American Jewish critic of Zionism, writing in 1988 in his book, The Hidden History of Zionism, pointedly noted the paper's intent of double-crossing Mubarak and emphasized that the Yanan paper hoped for the downfall and dissolution of Egypt, despite the 1979 Camp David peace agreement. This is geopolitics at its best or worst, and demonstrates the kind of gambles Israel has historically been willing to take. After all, Israel helped subsidize and nurture the fledgling Hamas faction within the Palestinian statehood movement as a means to counter and undermine the secular Fatah faction led by senior Palestinian statesman Yasser Arafat. But Hamas got out of control, grew in popularity, and now stands as one of Israel's chief rivals. Such gamesmanship by Israel is part of a philosophy known as catastrophic Zionism, a term used almost exclusively by Israeli and Jewish writers. The theme of catastrophic Zionism, sometimes called war Zionism, suggests that Israel as a state relies on crisis and the potential of war with its neighbors as a foundation of its very existence. This has actually been the belief of many hardline right-wing elements going back to the earliest days of Israel. In short, there are many Zionists who believe such crisis is vital, fundamental to Israel's survival. And for this reason, the believers in catastrophic Zionism will never lend their support to any policy, domestic or international, that could lead to a final solution of the conflict between Israel and its Arab and Muslim neighbors. In actual fact, this notion that peace could be dangerous to the survival of Israel is a governing concept in the minds of many Israelis and their supporters worldwide. Page 11. Foreign Interventionism, a Perilous Folly, editorial. The violent demonstrations sweeping the Middle East have been big news this week. The Tunisian government is toppled, Yemen is close to falling, Egyptian leader Hosni Mubarak is on the outs, we're told. Jordan's king has replaced his entire cabinet, and the Palestinian government in the West Bank has called for new elections. As AFPRC Chairman Vince Ryan writes in the article below, no one knows what the future will hold. Will these revolutions result in leaders rejecting the influence of the United States and Israel? Or will another group of easily corrupted despots rise to power? There is also growing concern that the demonstrations are being shaped by the usual culprits for the purpose of sowing further division and infighting between Shiites, Sunnis, and Christians. As far as Egypt is concerned, the Suez Canal is no doubt of strategic importance to many countries, including the United States. But as of 1950, Egypt, via the state-owned Suez Canal Authority, took the canal away from the bankers and the British government. So whoever takes power in Egypt will have control of the canal, and that controlling entity will undoubtedly want to trade with other countries. There is little doubt that those countries that remain neutral during the unrest there will have better standing than the countries that chose sides, especially if the wrong man wins. Upon leaving office, George Washington offered Americans these wise words: "The great rule of conduct for us in regard to foreign nations is, in extending our commercial relations, to have with them as little political connection as possible." That is why the only thing that should be of concern to patriotic Americans is that the U.S. never intervene in the internal affairs of other countries. This country's current obsession with attempting to control the domestic affairs of other nations cannot succeed in doing anything but involving us in wars in which we have no legitimate interest. It can only bankrupt the taxpayers. It was the case in Washington's time, and it is the same now. When will our politicians take heed of the sage counsel of our first president? In February, the Congress is to read aloud Washington's farewell address, as they did the Constitution in January. We hope they are paying close attention. Pro-Western Arab leaders watch Egyptian situation closely. The Ryan Report by Vince Ryan. As I write these words, the 30-year rule of Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak can't come to an end fast enough to suit his enemies, both at home and abroad. A former senior White House official, under condition of anonymity, told the Los Angeles Times, "They don't want to push Mubarak over the cliff, but they understand that the Mubarak era is over and that the only way Mubarak could be saved now is by a ruthless suppression of the population, which would probably set the stage for a much more radical revolution down the road. However, there is a big problem. A lot of our allies in the region, the Saudis, Jordanians, and Kuwaitis, will be particularly nervous if it looks like the United States is doing in one of their friends, the official added. Not surprisingly, neoconservative William Crystal, editor of the Weekly Standard magazine, has endorsed a statement of the Working Group on Egypt that calls for free elections in Egypt and a suspension of all economic and military assistance to that country. The fact is, writes Crystal, that Mubarak is now part of the problem, not part of the solution. And he adds, our goal for Egypt should be to turn that country away from being a dictatorship to becoming an American-supported and popularly elected legitimate liberal democracy. It is laughable to think that Egypt would suddenly spring into a Western-style Jeffersonian democracy. If free elections were held in that historic country, it's more than likely the Egyptians would elect a popular leader whose outlook reflects growing anti-Israel and anti-U.S. sentiments sweeping the region. Are rioting and looting proper ways to establish a legitimate regime? Our founding fathers fought two wars to establish our freedom, the War of the American Revolution and the War of 1812. These were the last legitimate wars that we fought because Britain was occupying our land and had to be tossed out. In Egypt, looters took it upon themselves to go after treasured antiquities. Associated Press reported that would-be looters broke into Cairo's famed Egyptian museum, ripping the heads off two mummies and damaging about 10 small artifacts before being caught and detained by army soldiers. Antiquities chief Zahi Hawass said that nothing was stolen and that the collection was safe and under military guard. The AP reported that military and armored personnel carriers and troops were dispatched to the pyramids of Giza, the temple city of Luxor, and other key archaeological monuments. In 1984, this writer, as managing editor of the now-defunct Spotlight newspaper, had the good fortune, along with 26 Spotlight supporters, under the guidance of a professional tour director, to visit Egypt. At the time, Egypt had a population of 41 million, compared with today's 80 million. We visited Egypt by airplane, boat, camel, train, and bus. A highlight of the trip was a cruise on the Nile traveling south. The Nile flows north to the Mediterranean. We also saw the two ancient temples of Pharaoh Ramses II, died 125 BC, which were moved in 1964 to protect them from waters backed up by the Aswan High Dam, as well as the central Egyptian village of Karnak, which features the Avenue of the Sphinxes, built by Ramses. On the final night of our group's stay in Egypt, we dined with General Samir Farid of the Egyptian Air Force, a lifelong friend of President Mubarak. The general stressed that modern Egypt is a young country that wants peace so that it can get on with the building of a state worthy of its great tradition and name. He pointed out that Mubarak as president doesn't prevail upon his friendship. He wanted Mubarak to succeed as a politician and was sure that he would. That was 1984. For 30 years, Mubarak has been a strong ally and friend of the United States. Today, in 2011, it's looking likely that Mubarak's regime could tumble. He has vowed not to run for re-election when his term is up in September. Whether he is allowed to hold on to his presidency for that long is anyone's guess. Whatever happens, my memories will remain of the Egypt I saw, one that has survived pharaohs, occupations, and despots over the course of thousands of years. Page 12, AFP on chemtrails. What's the truth about those ubiquitous chemtrails? By Frank Whalen. In the 2010 documentary, What in the World Are They Spraying?, filmmaker Michael J. Murphy delves into the mysterious and controversial topic of chemtrails, those apparent jet exhaust trails that crisscross the sky and resemble contrails, the normal condensation trails from jet exhaust. The difference is that chemtrails linger much longer than contrails and are said to be released into the skies as part of a clandestine program whose origin and purposes are not altogether clear. While speculation and debate have been circulating on this topic for several years, some facts are finally coming to light. Initially, Murphy was a skeptic about chemtrails. People have been conditioned to disbelieve things like this and are prone to distraction, he told this writer during a January 28th interview. After years of research and investigation, Murphy says his informed opinion now is that chemtrails, known more officially as geoengineering programs, are a crime against humanity and nature. When specifically asked why pilots or others involved in this scandal haven't spoken out, Murphy made a major revelation. They have come forward. They just haven't done so publicly. There is huge pressure on them to keep quiet, but involved individuals have privately confirmed my research. Murphy also proposed that the individuals ultimately responsible for the chemtrail phenomenon are scientists worried about global warming who want to fix the climate. Much has been made of the chemtrail versus contrail discourse. As far as the composition of the chemtrail artificial cloud cover goes, Murphy's film describes the high levels of poisons found in chemtrails, as well as the adverse effects these substances have on the environment and human health. Aluminum oxide is highly toxic and diminishes immune functions, as does barium, while strontium, in some isotopes, is a known carcinogen, he said, describing part of the composition of chemtrails. Murphy says that experts have told him the damaging effects caused by chemtrails on both the population and on the Earth generally are unquantifiable. He also looks to the scientific community for answers to an obvious question. Why would they do this to us? Geoengineers sell these programs as being for the greater good, that they are doing it to save the planet from global warming, Murphy stated. At the same time, they admit that starting such programs will ravage the ozone layer, allowing for higher levels of solar radiation to reach the surface of the Earth. Murphy also discussed the military applications of such a program, examining the potential for both weather modification as well as population control. Perhaps inevitably, HAARP, the High Frequency Active Auroral Research Program, an Alaskan-based research program that studies the ionosphere, but is allegedly also attempting to control the weather, came into the discussion as another example of geoengineering and possibly weaponizing the weather. When AFP asked if chemtrails and HAARP could be used in conjunction with each other, Murphy responded, absolutely, stating that higher concentrations of heavy metals would appear to make HAARP more effective. Interestingly, HAARP's official website addresses the question of whether it's capable of affecting the weather. The answer isn't what you might expect. Instead of dismissing such a possibility, the explanation on the site responds, "The HAARP facility will not affect the weather." It's important to note that the officials who run HAARP use the words "will not" as opposed to the anticipated answer of "cannot." Playing God isn't the same as being God, and there are consequences to scientific endeavors that attempt to control anything. In the case of geoengineering, obviously, one can conclude that a certain level of plausible deniability must be maintained. For example, if the government of any country were to acknowledge that it possessed the capability to steer hurricanes or cause earthquakes, then every time a hurricane struck or an earthquake occurred, victimized countries and individuals would say it was an intentional act. This could be construed as an act of war and pave the way for more conflicts. Murphy agreed, saying that a number of informed people have confirmed his research and conclusions, but are under extreme pressure to be silent. I would remind skeptics to look at the Manhattan Project for developing the atomic bomb in the 1940s, and how long it took for that program to be admitted to openly, he said. These are multi-billion, maybe multi-trillion dollar black operation projects. Despite such a well-funded assault, Murphy's spirits remain high. My hope lies in my fellow man, he said. This issue will not be solved by governments or politicians. It's up to us to become enlightened, and then to stand up and say, no more. Page 14, AFP on Genetically Modified Crops. USDA Ruling Imperils Food Supply by Christopher J. Petherick. Despite widespread opposition to genetically modified GM crops, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, USDA, recently approved GM alfalfa, threatening organic farms across the United States. In a related development, official Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, documents that were recently leaked show that the federal bureaucracy ignored concerns from its own scientists that a new advanced pesticide will likely kill honeybees. Bees are already struggling to survive in this country due to a mysterious and bizarre condition, colony collapse disorder, CCD. On January 27th, the USDA announced it would allow the unrestricted nationwide planting of genetically engineered alfalfa, reported the Rodale Institute, the nation's leading organic advocacy organization. The concern among organic growers is that in the years ahead, GM alfalfa will contaminate natural and organic alfalfa because, unlike most crops, alfalfa pollen can travel for miles, mixing in with other alfalfa varieties in the area. In a landmark 2006 study, Colorado State University researchers found GM alfalfa contaminated almost all of the alfalfa for miles around one test field that had been planted with the lab-created plants. They concluded the GM alfalfa gene was found at 83% of the collection sites, out to a distance of 1.7 miles from the pollen source. Why the concern over GM alfalfa? Well, alfalfa is the most common feed source for livestock such as cattle, sheep, and goats. Once an area farmer introduces GM alfalfa to his fields, organic farmers will no longer be able to guarantee that the meat, milk, cheese, and yogurt they produce will be GM-free. This would be a huge blow to both producers and consumers who value non-GM foods as a healthy alternative. Any organic growers who harvest and sell alfalfa seeds will likely be out of business, as their seeds may be contaminated by GM alfalfa. Moreover, many weeds and pests in the United States are growing resistant to common herbicides and pesticides. As a result, industrial farms use more and more toxic chemicals to control weeds, pests, and unwanted insects. In a related story, the EPA, following in the USDA's footsteps, quietly approved a new, highly toxic pesticide manufactured by the German chemical maker Bayer. The EPA's ruling came despite a study produced by its own scientists, which found the chemicals will further impact already suffering honeybee populations. Across the country, beekeepers have been puzzled about CCD, whereby as much as 50% of a hive can simply disappear without a trace. Some entomologists contend that a combination of a fungus and a virus is to blame for CCD, but others believe CCD is a more complex disorder caused by myriad environmental factors that disrupt complicated hive systems, breaking down honeybees' immune systems. These include heavy use of pesticides, poisoning bees, cellular towers, confusing bees' homing instinct, and even GM crops polluting hives. Anywhere from 30 to 40% of U.S. crops rely on bees to pollinate the plants. Pollination is, of course, the key ingredient to produce the fruits and seeds for the vegetables we eat. Without bees, many of the oldest varieties of fruit trees and vegetables would stop producing. These include multiple varieties of apples, nuts, avocados, soybeans, asparagus, broccoli, celery, squash, cucumbers, citruses, peaches, cherries, blueberries, cranberries, strawberries, cantaloupe, and other melons. The pesticide in question is part of a class of bug-killing chemicals known as neonicotinoids. These insecticides are particularly nasty, as they tend to be absorbed by the entire plant. Anything, insects, birds, rabbits, even people, that consumes a plant also ingests this toxin. Neonicotinoids even get into the pollen, which has some scientists very concerned about this chemical's effects on bees. Dr. Jeffrey Pettis at the USDA's Bee Research Laboratory in Greenbelt, Maryland, found that even at nearly imperceptible levels, neonicotinoids lowered bees' immune systems, rendering them incapable of defending against infectious diseases. Page 15, Tough Talk from Jim Trafficant. U.S. Can't Compete with Slave Labor, by Jim Trafficant. Massachusetts was not afraid to invest in the world's new economy, often labeled as the green economy. The state invested more than $70 million into Evergreen Solar, Inc., a firm that manufactures solar panels for this new American economy. Evergreen Solar, Inc. became the poster child for the state's strategic investment. It was almost too good to be true. Evergreen was opening a new factory at a closed military base employing some 800 workers in their initial first quarter. After all, they received that $70 million from the state, and the state was bragging about all the jobs, all the growth, all the new green projects being undertaken, and how Massachusetts had turned the corner, rebuilding its manufacturing infrastructure. Well, not quite. Evergreen has closed the Massachusetts factory and laid off all the workers, saying they are no longer economically feasible. The company further stated that they cannot compete with heavily subsidized solar manufacturers in China. Now, wasn't Evergreen subsidized by Massachusetts? If that's not enough to steam your dumplings, Evergreen will continue to operate its factories in China and in Midland, Michigan. Did China give the company cash? Did Michigan? If I were an Evergreen employee at that Michigan plant, I would not make any long-term financial commitments. Truth is, this whole stimulus, subsidization, economic theory is nothing more than new and expanded debt for the taxpayers, headlines for politicians, and pocket cash for savvy company CEOs, who simply roll the dice with our money. The green in Massachusetts is now on the faces of politicians who boasted of progress while simply wasting more taxpayer dollars. The state's motives were seemingly noble, but this was a foolish approach. When states offer companies tempting plans to remain in or relocate to a given state, many companies will visit the states with the best offers, hang around a while, and scarf up the booty. But nothing the cash-strapped states offer can ever financially outperform the distant slave laborer who works for fortune cookies. In a desperate attempt to convince voters of their brilliant ideas to save jobs in the manufacturing sector, today's politicians and administrators help questionable companies by gambling with public funds. One thing is for sure, they're not closing their plants in China. And to think, adequate tariffs on Chinese imports would cancel the financial advantage of hiring all that overseas labor and create an incentive for companies to stay in America. But American politicians yap about currency manipulation while ignoring the need for imposing such tariffs. Well, the financial bottom line is the deciding factor in all business and commercial venues. Michigan workers have probably emitted a sigh of relief, glad that it was Massachusetts that took the hit and not Michigan. But those companies aren't dumb. It's not beyond them to play one state against another to enjoy the windfall of state incentive packages. On the global plane where free trade reigns, nations are played against one another. Beam me up. I leave you with this. Try doing for your family what the government does, and see how long you stay out of jail. And don't forget to get back at me. Page 17, AFP on the global elite. Italian Prime Minister on Bilderberg Hit List by Pete Papahercules. A significant number of young women prostituted themselves with Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi, declared a document made public by Italian prosecutors on January 17th. The 74-year-old Berlusconi, a noted billionaire, is living a playboy lifestyle that easily rivals that of Bill Clinton. But Berlusconi, Italy's largest private media owner, operating TV and radio stations as well as magazines and newspapers, and owner of AC Milan, one of the top soccer teams in the world, reportedly is not cozy with the Bilderberg Group, or at least the secretive clique of media moguls, global bankers, corporate titans, and high-level government officials that meets behind closed doors each year is not comfortable with him. Thus, is the current media tizzy exploding in Italy actually a politically oriented smear, especially the fuss over allegations that the Prime Minister had sexual relations with a 17-year-old nightclub dancer? Berlusconi's political views have not always been popular with the elite global ruling class. As someone who's considered to be a right-wing conservative, Berlusconi opposes illegal immigration and has pledged to cut taxes. Meanwhile, Bilderberg attendees have complained that Berlusconi's actions will undermine the euro. The Bilderberg-controlled Washington Post has called Berlusconi the biggest challenge yet to the young euro currency. Berlusconi, although quite wealthy, appears to be far removed from Bilderberg and its agenda. Interestingly, he also maintains a close friendship with Russia's Vladimir Putin, which may also make the globalists a bit nervous, depending on how genuinely independent from Bilderberg influence Putin really is. Considering Italy's more tolerant attitude towards sex, with legal prostitution and the age of consent at 14, it appears that Berlusconi's enemies are trying to take him down on a technicality. For his part, Berlusconi, who is not trying to conceal his lifestyle, instead continues to thumb his nose at the globalists. Berlusconi denies any wrongdoing, and when asked if he plans to resign over the scandal, he told the mainstream press, "Are you mad? I'm having fun." In an Italy that appears to have turned into a Hollywood-style reality show, Berlusconi's main political rival, Nicci Vendola, is an openly homosexual ex-communist named after former Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev. Vendola wears a looped diamond earring, glittering black shoes with Velcro straps, and a paisley scarf. He also talks with a lisp and has a boyfriend named Ed. Vendola has accused Berlusconi of being a slimy bourgeois, in addition to telling anti-Semitic and homophobic jokes. Berlusconi responded, "It's better to like beautiful girls than to be gay." His alleged anti-Semitic jokes have also likely fueled the vendetta waged by his enemies. Among other things, during a party at his villa, Berlusconi was recorded telling a joke about an old Jew who admits that during the time of the death camps, he agreed to hide another Jew in his cellar, but forced him to pay $4,000 a day because we are Jews. The joke's punchline has the landlord asking his family if he should finally admit to the man in his cellar that Hitler is dead and that the war is over. Page 18, Uncensored News. Grand Architect of Iran's Sanctions Strategy Steps Down, by Keith Johnson. In late January, Stuart Levy, the chief enforcer of U.S. sanctions against Iran, quietly stepped down from his Treasury post as Undersecretary for Terrorism and Financial Intelligence, TFI, though making no public statement as to why he left. Jennifer Rubin of the Washington Post recently wrote that former staff and close associates of Levy informed her, 6.5 grueling years is enough, and the time has come for him to move on. Meanwhile, the Obama administration has appointed Levy's protege, David S. Cohen, to assume the undersecretary position. Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner and senior Obama administration officials stressed that this transition will have no effect on existing U.S. policies to increase financial pressure on Iran, North Korea, and others they identify as terrorist groups. Levy has often been described as the grand architect of sanctions against Iran. During his career with the Treasury Department, he has effectively strong-armed a number of international banks and corporations from doing business with this alleged pariah nation. But though he has been instrumental in refining some of the fiercer mafia tactics used to compel these entities to comply with U.S. demands, he is certainly not the architect of the overall strategy. That distinction belongs to the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, AIPAC, and its satellite Zionist organizations in the United States, particularly the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, WINEP. They are the driving force behind TFI, and Levy was merely its first functionary, working off blueprints drafted nearly two decades ago. In 1994, AIPAC's plan for action was designed to impose comprehensive sanctions on Iran. By 1995, AIPAC began an intense lobbying campaign to enact a complete trade embargo against Iran and a boycott of its global trading partners. A year later, Congress passed the Iran-Libyan Sanctions Act of 1996. This legislation took sanctions to a whole new level by imposing extraterritorial measures that infringed upon the sovereignty of other nations. Since then, AIPAC has been at the forefront of all legislation against Iran. AIPAC has been using its assets in the House and Senate to pressure three consecutive administrations into prosecuting its agenda. AIPAC's own website has admitted that the implementation and enforcement of Iran sanctions is its chief legislative priority. In 2004, following then-President Bush's re-election, AIPAC expanded its lobbying efforts to include the installation of a virtual branch office within the infrastructure of the U.S. government. Loyal AIPAC operatives like Senator Richard C. Shelby, Republican Alabama, and Senator Paul Sarbanes, Democrat Maryland, touted the merits of the Treasury Department and endorsed the creation of a special unit that would be used almost exclusively as a tool of economic warfare against Iran and its trading partners. It didn't take long before the TFI unit was born. For AIPAC, Levy was a natural choice to lead the unit. Aside from being Jewish and a zealous Israel firster, he also proved to be a faithful neoconservative Republican while serving as part of the legal team that assisted George W. Bush in the 2000 Florida recount. From there, he was recruited into the government and quickly promoted up the ranks. While serving at his Treasury post, Levy has repeatedly demonstrated his allegiance to AIPAC. In 2005, while speaking before an AIPAC policy conference, Levy revealed that he has had close ties with this illegally unregistered agent of a foreign power ever since his days in a one-year program at Hebrew University in 1983. One of Levy's mentors is the Muslim-hating Zionist Martin Peretz, who is an active WINEP board member and former editor-in-chief of The New Republic magazine. Levy is heralded by Zionist organizations for his work on behalf of Israel. He received the American Jewish Council's 2009 Public Service Award. It may be too early to speculate where Levy will end up next, but if we can glean any insights by tracking the destinations of former colleagues who've also left TFI, then it's a fairly safe bet that he could find a welcome home among any of a number of Israeli promoting organizations in the United States. It's business as usual in regard to his replacement. Cohen is a Levy clone who will function as AIPAC's new Treasury Department puppet, and it just might be Levy who ends up pulling the strings. Magnetic North Pole Shifted 40 Miles in 2010 Alone, by Keith Hansen. A short, seemingly innocuous article published by the Tampa Tribune during the first week of January captured much of the nation's attention and imagination. The Tribune story reported the Federal Aviation Administration had notified Tampa International Airport that three runways were due for redesignation because continual shifting of the magnetic North Pole, upon which the values are based, had finally created enough deviation to warrant a makeover. This year alone, the pole shifted approximately 40 miles in the direction of Russia, making current headings, whose values are painted on the runways, no longer accurate. As this story broke, it became clear that more than Tampa Bay area readers were intrigued with the goings-on at the airport as they quickly spread to global news media sites and other science-related websites. The aviation industry deals with magnetic pole shifts and airport adaptations as everyday business. The headings vary a couple of degrees per year, said Stephen Lemelin, a pilot for a major commercial carrier. The shift may be more rapid now, but it's imperceptible to aviation. Because the flying public has become accustomed to bad news regarding the industry, some riders took an opportunity not to disappoint by attaching dire consequences to the pole shift. One article warned that the variance between old runway headings and current magnetic headings would cause autopilot mechanisms to malfunction. The automatic pilot operates on the information pilot's input, said Lemelin, who has flown commercially for 24 years and is recently retired from the Naval Reserves. Our paper aerial charts, approach plates, and the software that is downloaded into the computer are updated at the same time. Lemelin added that pilots are aware of and required to check runway headings and current magnetic headings as a safeguard. Although aviation has always operated using magnetic north, those days appear to be numbered. Technology now exists that eliminates the need to rely on Earth's magnetic properties to navigate. An interesting aside to this episode will be the way in which the public reacts or ignores other runway redesignation. In October, not more than a few miles away from where the most recent one took place, St. Petersburg Clearwater International Airport is slated for its own runway renovation.